Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, you're listening to New Books in History. I'm your host, Dexter Fergie. Today, I'll be speaking with the historian Alan McPherson about his stunning new book called Ghosts of Sheridan Circle, How a Washington Assassination Brought Pinochet's Terror State to Justice. The book uncovers the harrowing story of the assassination of a former Allende diplomat named Orlando Letelier in Washington, D.C. McPherson masterfully puts all the pieces together to explain how Pinochet and his Secret Service goons did it, and then he follows the investigations that eventually held the assassins and the Chilean government accountable. It's a difficult and sad story, but it's also one of hope, and it's told with an eye for justice. So, Alan, I really want to thank you for coming onto the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, I should note that we are recording this on November 6th. And so, you know, this is in the context of the U.S. election. It's been a very distractible week. But I actually could not put this book down when I started it a couple of days ago.
Oh, that's great to hear. Yes. I mean, it's morning again in America.
Oh, no. Yeah. Let's dig into the book. So, firstly, why did you decide to write this particular book?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I didn't know much about this story and I wanted to know more about it. But I came around it sort of backwards by looking at the broader sort of relationship of the Reagan administration to Latin America. And I thought, I want to do something about Reagan in Latin America. And I was just reading broadly. And I came upon this book that's about Reagan and Pinochet. And it's pretty much the sort of high-level politics. It's very good. It's got all the latest documents. But it was everything about Reagan and Pinochet. But I realized reading that book that this incident, which takes place in 1976 during the Ford administration, and, you know, I thought was really resolved by the time that Reagan came to power, because I really knew it as sort of a 1970s event. But I realized that it remains a thorn in the side of U.S.-Chilean relationships throughout the 1980s and even into the 1990s. And so I thought, I don't think this part of the story has been told. And so I looked into the book that had been written especially about this, and there's really two to three big ones. They were all written in the early 1980s. And it all essentially ended the story about 1979, 1980, when, you know, the men who actually made the bomb and put it inside the car were, you know, fingered, most of them brought to court, some of them served time. But then there's the rest of the story, which is, what about the Chileans who ordered this bomb to be put in the car, right? And what about Pinochet and his secret police? And that's sort of the second half of the story. And so I thought, I think this story needs to be brought up to date. Plus the other element I realized, which I half knew, which is that we have so many more documents now on the U.S.-Chilean relation than we had in the early 80s. And so there had to be a lot more detail on the first half, and I was right, there is.
Mm-hmm. I think that your book is extremely good on that second half. So I'm glad that you were able to tell that. I think it would be useful for listeners to maybe talk about the assassination itself. So can you just sketch for us what happened in Washington, D.C. on September 21st, 1976?
Happy to. So September 21st, 1976, Orlando Letelier had been out of the Chilean government for 3 years and was working in a think tank, a leftist think tank in Washington, D.C. And so he was going to work that morning. He was living in Bethesda, Maryland, in the suburbs of D.C. And he happened to give a ride to two co-workers who were in the same organization, but they were much younger. He was 44. They were 25. They were actually just married. Michael Moffitt, Ronnie Moffitt, and Ronnie sat in the front passenger seat. Michael sat in the back, and Orlando drove his car. It was about 9:30 in the morning, so they made their way almost to DuPont Circle. And if you know your viewers know Washington, D.C., they know that DuPont Circle is a major traffic circle, but it's also where most of the sort of international organizations, think tanks, NGOs, have their offices. And Sheridan Circle is just down the street from that. So it's a less well-known circle, but it is ringed by embassies and ambassadors' residences. It's also at the end of Embassy Row, which is this long street of embassies on both sides of it. And so just as Letelier's car rounded the corner into DuPont Circle, there was a sedan had been following them for a while. They clicked a button essentially on a detonation device, and that exploded a bomb that was under Letelier's car, under his legs, sent the car several feet into the air. It crashed against the parked car. Letelier's legs were blown off immediately. He essentially bled to death within really a matter of minutes. Ronnie Moffitt was not targeted. There wasn't supposed to have been somebody else in the car. And so there was a good chance she would not have died, but she got out of the car, stumbled. Her husband saw her. Her husband, Michael, said, "Well, she seems to be okay. She's stumbling out of the car, so let me go save Orlando," because clearly that's where the explosion happened. Michael in the back was actually generally okay. He had a few sort of superficial cuts. The car was really blown apart. He sees his wife, essentially leaves her alone, goes, gets Orlando, can't pull him out because the metal is just tangled everywhere, realizes this guy has no legs. But it turns out that Ronnie Moffitt had been caught in the throat by a piece of shrapnel. It had cut her carotid artery, and she was therefore swallowing all this blood and drowning in her own blood. And so within a few minutes, the police showed up, ambulances showed up. There was actually this doctor who was walking to work at George Washington University Hospital, which was nearby. And she was a Black woman, and people didn't believe that she was a doctor, but she was trying to save Ronnie Moffitt's life. She knew exactly what she was doing, but it turned out that Ronnie Moffitt also was far too gone to be saved at that point. And so she died in George Washington Hospital, maybe half an hour later.
And so you start the book with this incident, and then from there you start to kind of do detective work to find out, like how it happened, what led to it. And in that process, you actually kind of become a biographer of all of the people involved, the people who carried it out, the people who, called for it and organized it, and then also the victims and survivors. And I think it would actually be useful and correct if for you to share with listeners who the Letelliers were and why Pinochet would have wanted to kill Orlando in the first place.
Sure. Yeah. There's a few chapters devoted to both Letelier's, him and his wife, and then to you know, Pinochet and his hatred for them. So Orlando Letelier was a socialist, socialist politician, and actually an economist. He had worked at the Inter-American Development Bank in Washington, so he knew Washington very well. This is in the 60s. In 1970, the Chileans vote for president a declared Marxist, Salvador Allende. He lasts 3 years in office, and his first ambassador to Washington is Orlando Letelier, because Orlando knows Washington so well. He's also, you know, very sophisticated, charming, intelligent, knows the United States, knows Chile's problems. He's close friends with Allende. He's also a socialist. And so he spends most of the Allende years in Washington. His wife is Isabel Letelier. I should say Isabel Morel de Letelier. Now she goes by Isabel Morel. And she is, a well-educated woman, very devout Catholic, but also somebody who, you know, gravitates towards socialism while in college in the 50s and 60s. They have four kids together. You know, and while they're at the IDB and they're at the embassy in the early 70s, she becomes, I wouldn't say a typical ambassador's wife, but she can't work. And so that's essentially what she's doing. But she does a lot of charity work, you know, so they're both very politically astute people. But they're pretty kind of, they're real social democrats in a sense, right? They want democracy to remain in Chile, but they also would like a socialist system. So eventually, close to the coup of 1973, the president Allende recalls the ambassador back home. He makes him Minister of the Interior for a while and then Minister of Defense. And I think he's in that last position for 9 days when the coup happens. I mean, he's barely got his bearings back in Santiago and, barely knows people in the military. The coup happens. He is taken prisoner and eventually flown out to the very southern tip of Chile. So almost the Antarctic. And he's put in essentially a concentration camp with other sort of high profile prisoners, right? Ministers and that sort of thing. He stays there for almost a whole year and then he goes to another prison. And essentially after a year, there's so much pressure against Pinochet to release these folks who've never been charged that he is released and ends up after a short stint in Venezuela, ends up in the United States in Washington, where he's offered a job at IPS, which is the Institute for Policy Studies. And so this is where Pinochet starts to want to kill him, right? Because when he's released, he's told in no uncertain terms, the general, which means, Pinochet, does not tolerate any kind of activities against his government. So they're warning him, you act against us while you're free and we're going to kill you. But, Letelier's conscience is too large to be restrained by anything like that. And he's willing to take those chances. So he begins to, be an activist, not for just sort of general matters like human rights and the global economy, but specifically against Pinochet, right? Sort of holds Pinochet as the ultimate enemy of human rights. And so Pinochet's government starts to see him and a few others whom they also kill or try to kill as Chileans who have gone abroad and are making trouble, right? And they fear specifically two things. One of them is true, which is that these people might cause disinvestment. Letelier is one of these people who convinces at least a major Dutch corporation to stop investing in Chile. Pinochet also believes a second thing, which is that Letelier and others are trying to form a government in exile, right, for an eventual return to Chile. And that is not true. Now, it is true that, Letelier and others are popular because they're able to kind of gather several people from the left and from the center, all sorts of anti-Pinochet forces. But they have no plans to return to Chile or to form a government in exile. Or they barely get along. And so for those reasons, he's targeted. And in fact, he's stripped of his citizenship, I think, about 10 days before he's killed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and your book is also a like deep dive into like the Pinochet security state, and that's actually one of the really fascinating things. You're able to get like up close into these these like spaces that are like secret, where Pinochet and people like Contreras are scheming to murder Chileans abroad. Can you say a little bit more about this security state, and in particular, like the Dirección de Inteligencia Nacional, or DINA, and sort of their attempt to kill all these lefty Chileans abroad?
Right. Well, that plot has a name. It's called Operation Condor. Mm-hmm. It is a multinational conspiracy by right-wing regimes, all military or dictatorial regimes. And it starts in about 1975. So it basically starts once Pinochet is firmly in power, in control of the Chilean state. And Argentina has also become a dictatorship. Brazil is already a dictatorship. So you've already got three. You've got Paraguay. You've got Uruguay. And so all of the powerful countries of the Southern Cone and of South America start coordinating their efforts to help each other sort of find their leftist dissidents, right? So, for instance, you might have these Chileans who left Chile, but maybe they live in Paraguay or they live in Buenos Aires. And so, right, the Argentine military will grab them and, you know, maybe kill them or torture them or send them back to Chile. So it's that sort of thing. And Operation Condor is overwhelmingly located within the countries controlled by these dictatorships. Now, there's also a small component of it which has to do, in which Letelier is killed, which is really sort of the extra-continental component of it, where Pinochet, you know, and his allies, and Manuel Contreras is the director of DINA, so he's the head of the secret police. And the secret police is really the one that sort of operates Operation Condor. And so they start targeting people outside of those countries. So that what it means is that you're going to kill people in countries where the governments don't know you're doing this and don't want you to do this, right? So for instance, somebody is killed, or is shot but not killed in Rome, Italy, right? And this is not coordinated with the Italian government, at least I don't think so. But, you know, there are these sort of plots to try to assassinate people all over the world, but very few of them succeed. But Letelier is the only one that is plotted that I know to any extent, and of course is then executed in the United States. So it gives you really a sense of how, you know, their sense of, you know, that they had all the power in the world, right? That their sense of impunity, that even, you know, allies who are not, you know, who knew about Operation Condor, like the United States, but were not, you know, full participants in it. Pinochet and Contreras thought that the United States would let them do this, right? Or that they just simply couldn't find them and couldn't punish them. So it really tells you about sort of the depth of this sense of impunity during the Cold War.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, what is so interesting about Operation Condor is that you have all these, nationalist regimes kind of like pooling their resources and trying to like overcome the limits that an interstate system impose on them. You know, like you can't just go, send your police into another country, but then they're able to kind of like form this transnational network, through which they can get Chileans that they don't like, or get Uruguayans that they don't like. It's a really fascinating and frightening case of like far right internationalism.
Yes, you're right. I mean, there's a real irony there in that, you know, Latin American countries, especially in South America, are particularly jealous of their nationalism, right? There's a lot of, not a lot of wars in Latin America, sort of, you know, cross-border wars, but a lot of little skirmishes. And even Pinochet almost goes to war against Peru, almost goes to war against Bolivia, and yet he's willing to sort of really collaborate with these allies, or at least Contreras is, right? Really willing to collaborate with these allies and letting them, you know, cross his border and take their people And I think it speaks to their sort of ideological extremes. You know, I mean, they considered themselves to be in sort of a war for civilization, right? They were not only, you know, sometimes they were cynical about things, but they really thought that communists were the devil. Even peaceful socialists who had come to power through elections, you know, were demonic, and they were going to bring the end of Christian civilization and certainly of Catholicism. And so they need to do, every means, were justified to pursue these ends.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I also picked up in Vincent Bevan's recent book on the Jakarta Method. I don't know if that's something that you've come across.
I've heard of it.
In all these cases, you have these like far right actors, kind of like imagining communists doing the exact same thing that they're really doing.
Yeah,
like executions and concentration camps, and it's this weird far right imaginary that imagines communists doing just like the most horrific things. There's another aspect to all this, which is Dina in Operation Condor, we're relying on these like very local actors. And another, another character that you bring up in your book is Michael Townley, who's an American by birth, but ends up in Chile. And then his wife, who is such a strange person and could definitely have their own book, Mariana Callejas. Can you just give like a quick description of who these people were and how what their role was in the assassination of Letelier?
Sure. I mean, Michael Townley is the one who has the direct role. And so you're exactly right. I describe him as an American Chilean because he is, his parents or his father works for the Ford Motor Company in Chile. So that's why he ends up there as a child. He goes through high school there, never goes to college. He's not particularly educated, speaks Spanish very well with what's somewhat of an accent, but he's very much considers himself Chilean. Really sort of adheres to the cause of socialism, even though he's not brought up particularly, to be very political. But he's sort of sucked into these far right groups during the Allende regime, right? There's these youth groups who are essentially proto-fascists. And they like him partly because he can teach them how to make bombs. So one thing he becomes good at in his, 20s is radio and bombs, right? He's sort of a tech guy, sort of a low-tech guy, but he can do, all sorts of hi-fi technology, that sort of thing. So he can make bombs. He can make radio-controlled bombs. He can make Molotov cocktails. And so they're really into him because of that. So once the coup occurs, then a lot of these sort of proto-fascists integrate into the government. They start doing the bidding of Pinochet. And so does Michael Townley. So Dina turns to Michael Townley, one, because he's a good bomb maker, and two, because he's an American. So not only does he speak English, but he can go back and forth to the United States and either buy bomb-making equipment or just connect with people there. And some of the people he connects with are other anti-communists and especially Cuban-Americans who hate Fidel Castro, who've moved to places like New Jersey and Florida and are willing to do anything that Pinochet asks them to. Pinochet is the ultimate sort of big man against communism in South America. So if you're associated with him, your stock goes up. So we can talk about the Cubans later. But, Townley is sort of the linchpin of all of these forces, so of Dina, of the United States, of the Cubans, and he can make a bomb. So he's sent out on several of these missions abroad and is implicated and has been in many, many court cases since then. But he's asked to make this bomb, put it under Letelier's car, and he does so. And he also marries Mariana Callejas. And she is an artist and a writer. She's actually 10 years older than he is. She's got a couple of kids, and she's already divorced by the time they get married. So, he's about 20, she's about 30. But he charms her off her feet, and the marriage doesn't go particularly well. They're both cheating on each other. But eventually she also is interested in these anti-Allende groups and then in Dina. She doesn't always like everything about them, their anti-Semitism, for instance. But she goes along with them because she feels this is the great cause of the moment. It's anti-communism, and I've got to be a part of it, and so does Michael. And Michael is sort of her way of getting into these groups because she can't feel, doesn't feel that she can offer much, or you know, these groups don't feel that she can offer much to them, but Michael can. And so she never goes to the United States as part of this plot, but he certainly does, and then exits before the killing.
Yeah, and you mentioned the Cuban Americans, and so this is it's just another, to me, a strange twist in the story. You have Cuban Americans who are doing the bidding of the Chilean government. Can you explain why and how, and just kind of cure me of my confusion?
Right. I mean, these guys are an interesting bunch. You know, it's kind of a long story, but Cuban Americans, you know, came by the hundreds of thousands out of Cuba in the early 60s, fleeing the Cuban Revolution. Most of them end up in South Florida, but a good amount, right, tens of thousands, end up mostly in New Jersey, right across the river from Manhattan. And so they create this Cuban community there. And Cubans all over the East Coast will start then creating these sort of small militant organizations. Some of them are peaceful, but quite militant in their ideology. Others are violent. In the early 60s, it's really not a problem for the U.S. government because they collaborate with the U.S. government. And many of them are trained by the CIA. Many of them are part of the exile force that heads out to Cuba in 1961 at the Bay of Pigs. But I'm sure many of your readers will know, your listeners will know that the Bay of Pigs is a failure, right? So the invasion of Cuba in 1961 fails. And after that, especially when the Johnson administration comes in late 63, they're a lot less interested in what these Cubans can do for them because they've essentially pledged never to try to take over Cuba again. So you've got thousands of folks, maybe tens of thousands, who have been trained in espionage and code breaking and, you know, weapons and bombs, who now have no U.S. government support. So not only are they prone to do violence against Cuba, but they're angry at the United States. So especially by the early 70s, when even the Nixon government is starting to think about normalizing relations with Cuba, these people then turn against the United States government in many ways. They say, we don't owe any allegiance to this government that has abandoned us. But the problem is we can't seem to overthrow Castro, right? No matter how many times we go in our small groups and start shooting things up or burning a cane field or something, we're never able to overthrow this pretty powerful government for a small island. So they start aiming at Cuban targets outside of Cuba. And so this tends to then overlap with the strategy of Dina, which is to kill enemies of Chile outside of Chile, right? And these people are killing friends of Cuba outside Cuba. And so bombs start going off all over the East Coast of the United States, and in fact, in many countries and many capitals of the world. So for instance, the Cuban office at the United Nations in New York gets bombed a couple of times, right? People who might be organizing trips to Cuba, humanitarian trips, that sort of thing, get either assassinated or their cars get bombed or their mailboxes get bombed. So not that many people are getting killed, but it's a slew of bombings. I mean, in the hundreds, right, in the mid-1970s. And so the Chileans see this and they say, well, these are the obvious guys who would help us out. Now, the Cubans are, like I said, there are dozens of these groups. And the way that you sort of distinguish yourself and elevate yourself in terms of stature is to affiliate yourself with a more powerful organization. And nobody in the Americas is a more powerful anti-communist than Augusto Pinochet. So this small group, this relatively small militant group called the Cuban Nationalist Movement in northern New Jersey decides to go to Chile. Some of them, go to Chile and they decide to trust Michael Townley. And he basically says, can you help me surveil this communist, right? And eventually we're going to assassinate him. And they're fine with that. And in fact, they don't even ask for any money from the Chileans, from the Chilean government, which is remarkable, right? So it gives you a sense of a measure of their sort of ideological commitment, right? I mean, you can criticize these guys for so many reasons, but they are really ideologically committed. They think they are spreading freedom around the world, right? And so that's why they eventually end up helping him. And in fact, when Townley puts the bomb in the car, he's actually in Letelier's, you know, he's in his driveway. And he puts it in, he tapes it up, and for some reason, it doesn't work. And so the Cubans have to go back the next night, retape it, you know, rejigger it, and they're the ones who then follow the car the next day and set off the bomb. So they're heavily involved in this.
Yeah, no, the Cuban-American terrorism phenomenon is such an interesting process, historical event that I wish there was more written about.
Yes, I know some very promising young historians who are working on it, so I think we will hear more. But keep in mind just this one statistic that will give you a sense of how important they were. In 1974, Cuban-Americans accounted for 45% of all terrorist bombings on the planet.
Yeah.
Just Cuban-Americans.
Wow.
And that's remarkable, you know, and it dropped off by about the early 1980s. But the 70s were really a time when there was a major terrorist wave of Cuban-American bombings in the United States, and it's largely forgotten by most Americans.
Yeah, wow, yeah, that stat says so much. And so, okay, so, you know, we have American citizens doing the bidding of the Chilean governments. So you have, you know, Townley, the Cuban Americans. They're the ones who actually carry out the assassination of a former Chilean diplomat. And they also kill an American associate of that diplomat. And they do this all in the United States, in the Capitol. And they're doing this on behalf of a foreign government. So this is just like a really strange, like, I don't know, like legal hodgepodge situation. Like how did the U.S. handle the assassination?
Well, let me speak to sort of what legally this means, right? First, one is that you've committed several crimes, but you've, by killing these, I think the Chileans thought maybe that if you kill a Chilean abroad, it's not really a crime in the United States. Now, they would have thought twice had they read the U.S. Code, which says that if you've been an ambassador in the United States, you're forever a protected person, no matter what your nationality. And so a crime against you becomes a federal crime. And so the FBI is going to investigate this. Second, of course, they didn't really communicate to the Chileans that there should not be somebody else in the car. And so, you know, although they had told Townley, but, you know, through this game of telephone, I think the message got lost that you really, really should not kill another person. There shouldn't be collateral damage, but there was. So they killed a U.S. citizen. So that's a separate crime. And then there's all the crimes about, you know, conspiracy to do this, conspiracy to do that, destroying the car, right? There's like nine different crimes committed with this one bomb. Because it's in Washington, it's also, it's essentially quickly out of the hands of the Washington, D.C. police, and it goes to the FBI. It's handled in, you know, in federal courts. And I think all of this was not particularly considered by the Chileans. You know, there's this interesting episode in the book where Contreras's right-hand man, his name is Espinosa, has a conversation with Michael Townley in which he tells him who the target is. And then Townley starts saying, well, how do you want me to kill him? And Espinosa basically says, well, try to do it quietly. You know, maybe a mugging or a strangling, or make it look like it was just accidental. But the Chileans around the world will get the message without really raising alarm bells in Washington, right, with the White House and with the FBI. But Townley says, well, I don't really do that. You know, I'm not a stone cold killer. I just make bombs. And the bomb will kill him for sure, you know. And so Espinosa starts hemming and hawing and says, well, okay, but maybe you could do it really a quiet bomb, or make sure it's in a park, or make sure there's nobody else around. Don't kill any innocent people. And Townley says, well, I'll try, you know. So it's this absurd conversation where they tell a bomb maker to kill someone, but they tell him not to kill them with a bomb. And he says, well, that's what I do, you know. And so they finally say, fine, go ahead, just kill him, you know, as long as he's dead. But they're not really thinking about the sort of political and legal implications of doing all these things. So how does the police handle this? It becomes a major investigation. It's what's called a special at the FBI, or was back then. Of course, FBI is under the Department of Justice. And so there's assistant, you know, U.S. attorneys involved in this. This is, you know, it's pretty clear that this is done by outsiders, Chileans or Cubans. And, you know, they've got the scent pretty quickly that it's one of these two groups and maybe both of these groups together. But it takes about a year and a half to get any decent proof. And there's essentially sort of two elements that tie them to Townley and to the Cubans and therefore to the Chileans. One is that they've got some informants inside of the Cuban networks. And one of them basically is told by one of the Cubans that they've done it, you know, is bragging about it. And so this small time crook calls his FBI handler and says, you'll never believe what this guy just told me. And so finally they have, you know, somebody who can testify. And at the same time, they are finding that there are these two photographs, because there's these two Chileans who applied to come to the United States and they wanted American visas, but it sounded very fishy. And somehow they were refused a visa into the United States, but they had the applications were separated from the photographs. So they have these two photographs that have no names on them. And they are photographs of Michael Townley and then another Chilean who eventually did come to the United States with Townley. His name is Fernandez. And so the FBI or the Attorney General's office eventually publishes these two photographs in a new Washington newspaper called the Washington Star. And then the Chileans the next day run these photographs in their own newspapers. And within a couple of days, it's clear to everyone who these guys are, right? What the Americans had were fake names, and nobody could find people with those names. But now they publish the photos, and the Chile, you know, and it comes out in Chile that this is Townley and Fernandez.
Mm-hmm. And the Chilean government, you know, is not cooperating, especially at the beginning. But pretty quickly, they sense the severity of the situation, and so once. Those pictures are published and the men are identified. You know, Pinochet himself is he's starting to get a little tense. They ease on certain aspects of authoritarianism. They release political prisoners, but then you have this really interesting sort of scene where Pinochet walks into a meeting and tells his advisors that the Michael Townley situation, you know, once the U.S. government starts calling for his expulsion, he called it a banana peel. And if we step on it, the government will fall. We will fall. Can you talk a little bit about Chile's response to the investigation and the broader case?
Right. No, that's a great episode. I read this in a Chilean biography of Pinochet. So once the photos are published in Chile, you know, all hell breaks loose and things start happening very quickly. And, you know, you have to think about what the United States was thinking at the time, or the Attorney General's office. If they publish these photos, one of the possibilities is that these men will just disappear, right? They will be killed, buried, and you'll bury your best lead. But they feel at this point they've got to take that risk. And it turns out that it works, because the press in Chile is just free enough to publish this kind of thing and then to publish the names once they have the names. Because the press in Chile is not, you know, systematically muzzled, but it's intimidated. And so it knows it's certain things that they cannot say. But this is an American story to them, right? It's being talked about in the United States. It's an American crime. So there's a sense that it can't really touch Chile. It's just sort of a foreign crime. And so they publish the photos. And so you don't really know what the editors were thinking, right, in Chile. Are they trying to, you know, to sort of to jab at Pinochet through this technique? But it certainly hurts him. I mean, there's always elements inside the Chilean government that want a relaxation of human rights violations, right? Chile has long been a democracy throughout almost all of the 20th century. It's a shock to a lot of Chileans, and especially Chileans in the military, who certainly are anti-communist, but they never thought that there would be a years-long crackdown on any kind of dissidents within Chile. And there's criticisms of Pinochet, right? Pinochet is not all powerful within the government. He's got sometimes, you know, semi-vocal opposition from other generals. And so I think this is what he means when he says, you know, Chile might fall because there might be an internal coup. And so at this point, they're considering whether or not to hand over Townley. So there's also the legal issue that Townley is an American citizen. So the strategy of the Americans is to go for Townley, rather than try to punish any kind of Chileans or ask for extradition. They will do that later, but their first strategy is get Townley, tell them all we want is Michael Townley, right? First of all, produce him. Once you produce him, we should ask questions. And then, you know, but Townley lies, of course, to all the questions. And then they say, okay, we're going to ask for him to be not even extradited, but expelled. And there is sort of a provision in law in which you can expel people. It's not particularly legal, but Pinochet does it anyways. And so they put Townley in handcuffs and they spirit him out of the country. In fact, on a private airline, right? Like Ecuadoriana Airlines. And so it could have been that it could have landed anywhere in the world and the FBI couldn't have done anything because you can't arrest a man until he's on U.S. soil. So that's sort of a harrowing several hours on this flight that stops at all these places. So nobody's really sure of what's going to happen, but the Chileans essentially buckle. And I think they're hoping, okay, they've got Townley and Townley's probably not going to say anything or incriminate himself. And therefore we're fine, right? We've given them the American, they're going to leave us alone. But it turns out that Townley blabs, right? He spills all the beans from the very beginning of his involvement with the Chileans. And so most of the details of what we have of the conversations, right, between him and the Cubans, him and the Chileans, is from Townley's court testimony. So it's several days of testimony, and it's really riveting.
Mm-hmm. I mean, just as a side note, I was thoroughly impressed with all the dialogue that you include in the book. At times it read, it almost had like a novelistic character to it, where, you know, you really plant your readers into these, these like real live historical scenes. And you just like quote dialogue, like all over the place. And so I actually really appreciated that part of the book.
Well, thank you. I mean, that, you know, part of that dialogue, especially in the earlier part of the book, part of it is from a few other books that were published in the early 80s. Saul Landau and John Dinges, right? These activists and journalists published the best book in the early 80s. Taylor Branch, a very well-known journalist, published another one along with the head of the investigation. And so both of these books have a lot of dialogue. And so some of the dialogue in the book recreates that dialogue. But then there's other dialogue that's either after those events or it's other things that I found. And sometimes it's, you know, dialogue that comes straight in the story. It's like a journalist who maybe writes a story and you've got a dialogue there, you've got a conversation. Sometimes you kind of have to create that conversation because you might have, for instance, a memorandum of a conversation from the FBI, let's say. And so one FBI agent will say, well, I talked to a Cuban and I said this and he said that, then I responded this and he responded that. And it's not exactly a word for word conversation, but you can create a conversation because you know, right, what they were saying. Sometimes you even know what they were thinking because they'll say, I was thinking this, and so I said that. You know, so you can even sort of put thoughts into their minds because they've told you these were their thoughts. And so sometimes there's a little bit of sort of recreation of this, But it takes a lot of work to create these moments.
I was wondering about that. In academic writing, or at least academic historical writing, you don't see many dialogues. at least in your book, it really captures the drama of so much of the story when you have these like real live conversations that took place. We haven't talked too much about it, but I would love to hear more about Isabelle de Tellier's fight for justice, and she and some American lawyers launched a civil suit against the Chilean government for the wrongful death of her husband. Can you just say a little bit about this story?
Sure. If you look at the book, if there's one sort of central character that runs through the whole book, it's Isabelle Tellier. It's the widow, because she's there from the beginning, right? From essentially the first real chapter where the first chapter is not about Orlando. It's about Orlando and Isabelle, how they fall in love, how they become politicized, how they sort of rise through the ranks. And the last chapter is always, the last half really is about her pursuing justice. So it's partly about her continuing the work of her husband. So working for human rights in Latin America, working for women's rights, especially indigenous peoples. She was less concerned with sort of the world economy and, reordering the world economy the way her economist husband was, but she was more focused on rights. And she did, tremendous amount of work on that. She was also important in founding what's called the Letelier Moffitt Human Rights Award. So it's given by IPS at a ceremony every year in Washington, D.C. It gathers all of the important people around IPS and the people who knew. So I went last year and it was great. The book was out. I was able to kind of see what these celebrations are about. And they always give prizes to one U.S.-based group and one international group. And they're always working for human rights. And so this terrible event has inspired a legacy of sort of creating this network of different human rights organizations, right, that all essentially revolve around IPS in Washington. So that's why IPS is really important also to the story. And Isabelle's long work with IPS is very important to this. So then, partly separately from her IPS job, she's pursuing her husband's case. So she's always part of the plaintiffs in criminal cases, and there are a few criminal cases. But then she also is suing the Chilean government in a civil case to get essentially reparations, right? So she and her four sons and Michael Moffitt, who has survived the bombing, are suing the Chilean government for dollar reparations. And eventually, I think they asked for something like $5 million. Which is, not a fortune for the Chilean government. And in fact, once one judge in the United States says, yes, you have the right to sue, what happens is that they immediately sort of execute the judgment by attaching a piece of Chilean property to the judgment. And what that means is that they ground a plane of the Chilean airline, right? It's a Chilean national airline owned by the government. Chile basically says, well, we own it, but we don't control it. Therefore, you can't have our plane. Some U.S. courts are saying, yes, we can. Right? It's essentially a $5 million plane. It's worth what we feel you owe these families. But then that decision will be reversed in civil courts. In fact, the whole story is in the book, but I've also got an article in Law Journal that's coming out pretty soon about this court case. There's two separate court cases and how they have influenced the history of sort of counterterrorism in the United States through civil courts, right? There's a whole history of suing terrorists for damages rather than suing terrorists for criminal offenses. And so this is part of that long legal history.
I would be really excited to read that because, your entire book is really about borders in different ways, like violence across borders and then how to pursue justice across borders. The civil case where they tried to you know, basically take Chilean assets in the United States, it just raises so many questions about, you know, the boundaries between states, and then also, you know, like you have, you know, a country kind of like operating, you know, a company beyond its borders, and that raises other. It really is like an interesting story in its own right.
It is. I mean, it's a fascinating tale of just this this Chilean airline and what they did, and does it constitute, you know, criminal, you know, sort of criminal behavior? Because it's clear that all of these guys knew that Dina was using its planes to traffic materials, traffic agents. I mean, at some point, you know, at some point, apparently they even gave Michael Townley, they let him into the control while the plane was in the air, right, into the cockpit. Sometimes they gave him control of the airplane just for kicks, right? They let him smuggle bomb-making materials on the plane, and they knew all this. And they were basically told by Dina, you have to let this guy do whatever he wants. The U.S. government knew all of this, or at least finds out, you know, a few years after the fact, and excuses the Chilean government from almost all of these charges because they say, well, it's not really clear that the Chilean government owns this airline. And it was 5 years ago. So, you know, we can forgive this. I mean, that's what happens when you have Cold War allies, right? You forgive a lot of their sins, even though they're pretty serious sins. And at some point, Townley even had this liquid that was basically like sarin gas, but in liquid form and in a Chanel No. 5 perfume bottle that he just put like in his shirt pocket, right, on the plane. So if he had just sort of tripped on the plane, this thing had fallen and it would have gotten out, it would have killed everyone on the plane, including the pilots. The plane would have crashed, you know, and nobody's asking these questions, right? They're, you know, he often didn't have to go through security before getting on these planes, so he could carry anything he wanted on these planes. And so the judges in the U.S., some of them are saying, this is outrageous behavior. We can't let people do this. But, you know, international treaties often allow you to do this. There's international norms that make it very, very difficult to sue foreign countries. And so the United States was often sort of legally stuck and couldn't really do much. So it's really, to finish the sort of reparation story, it's really with the end of the Cold War and the change in government that the Letelier and the Moffat families get reparations, right? And I should also say there's Ronnie Moffat's parents, so those are the Carpins, who are also suffering through this. They lose their daughter, who's 25 in the prime of her life. And I think they get a little bit of money out of this also. But eventually what happens is that Pinochet is out of power by 1990. The Bush administration, the Bush first administration, wants to normalize relations with the Chilean government, cannot do so until there's progress on this one case, right? This has been passed into law by the Congress. You have to have progress on the Letelier-Moffat case to normalize relations. So Bush also wants to visit Chile. He wants to integrate Chile into NAFTA. And so they put together a commission once democracy has returned to Chile that will decide if these families get anything and how much. And they decide on something like $2.9 million. And so the families eventually get that kind of money by 1992, 1993 under the Bush administration. And so they do get something. And with that, they're able to kind of finally be done with these civil cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, or if we didn't talk about what happens to the culprits. And so, you know, the people who carry out the assassination are charged with the exception of Michael. Actually, you'll have to explain all this.
Yeah, but, it's complicated. I might not get all the details right, but essentially this is what happens. So Townley makes his confession in mid-1978, right? So this is a year and a half after he's committed the crime. He fingers all the Cubans. There's five Cubans who are then dragged into court with him, except two of them are already on the lam. So three others are actually physically dragged into court. They're all found guilty. Michael Townley strikes a deal, right? So he gets 3 years in prison. Once he's finished with prison, he goes into witness protection program, and he is still alive, as far as I know, and still living under witness protection program. Once in a while, he is trotted out and testifies in some case or gives an interview. As far as I know, that hasn't happened in 10 to 15 years, but I'm assuming he's still alive. I'm not sure we would find out publicly if he died, but I'm guessing somebody would tell us. So he's not that old. He's probably in his 70s, maybe 80s. So my guess is he's still alive and probably living on the East Coast somewhere. The three Cubans are found guilty of just about everything they're accused of. They spend a little bit of time in jail, but then their case gets – there's an appeal, and then all their three cases get overturned on essentially technicalities. I mean, these are ridiculous technicalities, but this happens all the time in the U.S. criminal system. So these guys serve almost no time in jail. Two other Cubans are on the lam until 1990, I think. And both of them are found by the FBI within months of each other, living in South Florida, out in the open. They've barely changed their names, right? But because they're sort of in this sea of Cuban Americans, the FBI is not really looking for them anymore. Interestingly, one of them is found through a television program. So back then, there was a very famous TV show called, America's Enemy Number One, or America's Most Wanted, Wanted. And it would show these, it was like a real crime TV series. And it wouldn't, you know, dramatize them, but it would show images of these people and saying, if you know where these guys are, we're looking for them, call this number. And it would get, you know, they solved so many crimes through this very sensationalistic TV show. That's how they caught one of these five Cubans. And so by 1990, these two guys get caught. And by then, the court systems are a little bit tougher on these guys, and they do spend, I think, 7 or 8 years in prison. And remember, you know, these guys helped make a bomb. I can't remember if these guys actually pushed the button or not, but they were part of this conspiracy, but they didn't, you know, physically kill anyone. They didn't order the crime. So 7 to 8 years seems reasonable. I think they're given 12 and they serve 7 to 8. So that's pretty reasonable. But these other three guys, and now these five guys, as far as I know, are still alive. They all live in Florida, I think. Well, at least 3 or 4 of them live in Florida. They still know each other. I've seen pictures of them that's like 5 years old. They give interviews in which they essentially, confess to having done this crime. And they're heroes. They're heroes in the Miami Cuban community, even though they're essentially confessed terrorists. So that tells you a lot about the sort of Miami Cuban community that, you know, once again, just voted for a Republican president, right? Because they were scared into believing that communism was coming to America, right? So there's some real parallels here. So those guys are all free today. What happens to the Chileans is that there are essentially three Chileans that could go to jail over this. Contreras, the head of secret police, Espinosa, his right-hand man, and Fernandez, who does some surveilling. So he's a lesser port person. All three, in the early 80s, are the Americans ask for them to be extradited to the United States. And a whole trial happens in Chile, and it's refused, right? Because clearly, these are military courts, and there's no way that Pinochet's Chilean, you know, military-dominated courts is going to allow three military men from Chile to be sent to the United States. Still, you know, the United States has to try it, and it fails. So throughout the 1980s, it's very difficult for the Letelier family to keep the case alive in Chilean courts, but they managed to do it. And 1 or 2 days before the statute of limitation is going to expire on two remaining guys, because Fernandez defects to the United States in the 80s. But the two big guys are left. And by this point, it's 1991. Pinochet is out. The Democrats are back in. And they indict Contreras and Espinosa. It takes 2 years to find them guilty. And it takes 2 more years for the Supreme Court to ratify the sentences. And that is when Contreras, right, the former head of the secret police and his chief of operations, finally go to prison. And they go to a prison that is built just for them. That's how scared the civilians in Chile are of the military, even 4 to 5 years after the military is no longer running the government, right? But Pinochet is still there, and he's either head of the military or he's a senator at this point, but he's still very powerful. But finally, my book essentially ends in 1995 when these two guys go to prison. And while I was writing the book, Contreras, who's sort of, you know, the big bad guy in the movie, in the book, died in 2015 while I started writing this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when he died, he was serving something like over 50 sentences that amounted to about 526 years. So he's definitely a bad guy in the book. And I know that I've already taken up a lot of your time, but I think it'd be worthwhile to just talk about one more thing, which is like, I want to take a step back from all of this. I would like to hear your thoughts on what this all means for like U.S. foreign policy and, U.S. Chilean relations. What is like your takeaway from, you know, the incident and the fallout and all of that?
Yeah. Well, God, it means so many things. For the United States, one thing that stands out to me is sort of the folly of allying with dictators, right? Because, you know, a government like the Nixon / Kissinger government of the mid-1970s really was falling in line with Pinochet almost more than Pinochet was falling in line with them. I mean, they knew about Operation Condor. In some ways, they assisted in Operation Condor. They certainly sort of turned a blind eye to everything that it was doing. It basically didn't want to know, but also didn't want to stop it because it was serving their needs. But they also lost control over it, right? Once you have an ally that is a monster like Pinochet and you empower him to do so much evil, he's going to think that he can do anything he wants, anywhere he wants. And so it's really a story of the United States sort of losing control of the Cold War, right? I mean, these guys are so ideologically driven and so violent and so empowered by the tools of the U.S. empire that they feel like they can go way beyond what even the United States, right, their patron country, wants them to do. And so it's a story of them, both parties, Democrats and Republicans, deciding we got to rein this guy in, right? He's gone way too far off the reservation. But it's very difficult to do that because he's so empowered by the tools you've given him and sometimes literally by the weapons and the money you've given him. Now, what it means for human rights in Chile and South America is equally as important, I would say. So this isn't necessarily U.S.-Chilean relations, but it's sort of Chilean politics and South American politics, in that this case sets many precedents. It's an exception in some ways because it happens in D.C., but because it happens in D.C., it allows the Chilean jurists to prosecute this case first, right? Under Pinochet, there was a law called the Amnesty Law. It's in fact still on the books. And it said that you could not punish anyone in Chilean government for crimes committed between the day of the coup and sometime in 1978, which is the worst of it, right? I mean, almost everything happens in those years. And so normally that would include Letelier, but the United States government insists that you cannot include the Letelier case in this amnesty law. And so it is explicitly excluded, which means that the United States, and therefore Chileans too, can pursue this case. So it allows the freeing of a lot of documents within Chile and a lot of testimony. And so those documents can then be used in other cases. And of course, it outs Contreras and Espinosa and Fernandez, and it links them to Pinochet. There's a whole debate about whether Pinochet or not ordered this particular hit. In the 1980s, the CIA comes to the conclusion that, yes, he did. And by the way, that conclusion reached by the CIA in the 80s was only made public in 2015 after I started researching this book, right? And this document came out that where the CIA said, we believe that Pinochet did this. It's not just Contreras, right? It's not just the secret police choosing the target, it's Pinochet. So the case allows also the Chilean journalistic establishment to report more on human rights and to report on this one specific case. It tends to sort of awaken Chileans who might be kind of not really politically inclined to think much harder about how terrible this government is, right? Because once you get rid of the dissidents and the leftists, most everybody else is just kind of scared, but a lot of them think, well, Pinochet is not that bad a guy. He's restored peace. He's gotten rid of communism. You know, this is not so bad, right? The economy is doing relatively well. Sometimes it did, sometimes it didn't. But this case keeps hammering at that myth, right? That Pinochet is a patriot and innocent. And there, you know, the case stays alive through the 80s and the early 90s. And so it's constantly allowing other jurists to say, once we push this case through, then we can find ways of punishing these same men or different men for different human rights violations. And that's exactly what happens in the 1990s, right? They find all sorts of legal ways of getting around the amnesty law, but they're inspired, and in many ways, they're directly, you know, empowered by the Letelier case. And so it's very, you know, when Contreras and Espinosa go to prison in 1995, they are the first Chileans to go to prison for human rights violations committed during the Cold War. And they, in fact, they might be the first Latin Americans, right, sort of military men, to go to prison for human rights violations during the Cold War. So it's a remarkably important and consequential case for human rights, for counterterrorism, right, for all sorts of reasons.
Well, Alan, I really want to thank you for speaking with me today. I learned so much from your book and learned more just hearing you talk. So thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And I'm Dexter Fergie. You've been listening to New Books in History.